Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2025 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2024, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a staggering $150,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial festivals and online programs. Imagining the Past is commercial-free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation, and we can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website, www.hnsa.org.au. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. Beverly McWilliams' writing has been published online and in magazines, and she's a regular contributor to The School magazine, Australia's longest-running literary publication for children. In August 2019, she published her debut picture book, Born to Fly, which received a notable commendation from the CBCA. Beverly's second novel, Spies in the Sky, flew into first place in the 2024 ARA Historical Novel Prize CYA category. It's a great pleasure to welcome her to Imagining the Past and to discuss all things pigeon and writing.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I always start by asking people, what was their path to becoming an author? How did that all come about?
Yeah, so for me, it probably wasn't the normal pathway. So my background's actually in law and accountancy, and I used to work in corporate tax. So quite different from writing. It was when I moved to Australia with my young family that I started to write. So I had young children and I thought I don't really want to go back into that just yet. So I stayed at home, spent some time with the family, but I needed something to keep my brain going, really, something different. So I started writing more for pleasure. I mean, I always enjoyed writing. I used to write a lot when I was younger, but I never thought of it as a career.
What kind of year was that you came to Australia?
So I came out to Australia in 2015-ish, I think. So it wasn't straight away. I started writing. I had young children at the time. I think it was sort of a year or two down the line.
I'm always also interested in stories of migration. What inspired you to shift country?
To come to Australia. I think we just wanted a better life for the children, really. A better future, a better education. It was hard. I was very close to my family. I'm from Yorkshire and I really love where I'm from. So it was very difficult. So I think, again, maybe that had something to do with me writing. It was me trying to help myself settle, find a place here. It did actually. It was an important part of me settling into Australia because, I started to join writing organisations. I found friends that way.
It's a long way from torts and profit and loss statements.
Yeah, it is a long way. And I've forgotten all that stuff now. So I even struggle to do my tax return.
Well, don't tell Jim Chambers that. So what was your first inspiration for the novel Spies in the Sky? How did you find the story?
Yeah, well, I've always loved pigeons, and I knew that they played a part in the war. I knew they were messengers in the war. I had that in my head. But I think the idea for the book probably came when we adopted a rescue pigeon, and I was looking for a name for her, and I stumbled on a list of pigeons that had been awarded the Dickey Medal in World War II. And yeah, I didn't realize quite how many pigeons had been awarded this medal. I think it was 32 out of 53. And I didn't know, I knew there'd be messengers in war, but I didn't know the extent of the part they'd played in war. So that sort of got me delving into looking into the history and the role that pigeons played in the war. And yeah, the more I learned, the more I thought, wow, this would make a great story for children.
I didn't know you could adopt a pigeon.
Well, yeah, kind of somebody had found a pigeon that had they'd sort of fished out of a lake, and they thought she was blind and she couldn't fly, and it was like, will anybody take this pigeon? And I'm a bit of a sucker for adopting animals. I have a kind of aviary full of adopted animals, so that's how it came about. So I've always loved pigeons, but yeah, that's what inspired the story, really, was finding a name for this pigeon. And
So what exactly though about the story, enchanted you? It's one thing to say you
well,
like pigeons, but
initially, yeah, I love pigeons, and I love that idea. I've always been a fan of kind of the underdogs, and I love the idea that I think pigeons have quite a bad reputation. So I love the idea of them being the heroes. But yeah, when I was looking at that list and I stumbled across the fact that there was this pigeon royal blue that belonged to King George VI, I thought, wow, that would be a fun take on a story, a royal pigeon going to war and the impact of, class. And so that's how I sort of came with the idea of using Royal Blue as the main character. But yeah, I selected all my characters from the Dickin, or the characters that went to war, I selected them from the Dickin Medal Award winning pigeons. And that's how I sort of came up with my characters. And I used what I found out about those pigeons to kind of create their personality.
yeah, I
And
mean it's kind of an obvious story in a way, but it's not something I'd ever heard of
yeah.
or known about. So what age group is the novel written for?
I would say it probably best suits maybe 9 to 13-year-olds, but I think because it's an adventure story, I think younger children could enjoy it, and parents or caregivers could read it to younger children and they'd appreciate it as an adventure story. I think older children would probably get more out of it, more out of the history side of it. But even adults, I enjoy reading a children's historical fiction novel, so I think that there's a lot in it, and there's a lot of facts at the back for the fact-loving readers. But I would say it's ideally I wrote it with the age group of sort of 9 to 13, in mind.
Why historical fiction for you? What have you always written historical fiction? And if so, what is it that kind of interests or inspires you about that?
So I do a bit of genre jumping. So I have written a bit of fiction. I write mainly non-fiction and historical fiction, but it's definitely historical fiction that I love. I think it's because it's kind of that crossover between non-fiction, and I'm a real facty person, so I love research. I love that side of it. But historical fiction also gives you the opportunity to be more creative, to create characters to build on history. So yeah, I love that. And I always enjoyed reading historical fiction. And I think there's so much you can learn from it. And so I love the idea that I'm giving children sort of that insight into history, without being, too didactic. It's not a history lesson, but there's a lot that you can pick up in the book. And from start to finish, I did a lot of research into it. So there is so much there to learn. And yeah, history's fun, and I think it's a great gateway into history.
You've kind of touched on this a bit, but what's, your involvement with pigeons? I don't know a lot about them being able to navigate and things like that. How did you kind of come to have a, or gain all of that knowledge of, about how they can navigate and things like that?
Yeah, well, I mean, my basic knowledge of pigeons came from keeping them. So I did adopt a pigeon, then I adopted a few more. So I have that lovely background into having my own pigeons, but my pigeons are just pets, not racing pigeons. So yeah, I did have to do quite a lot of research to expand upon that basic knowledge. So I actually read a lot of scientific papers on their navigation, because it's still not completely known exactly how they do it. It's a combination of different things that they use to navigate. So I did a lot of that kind of scientific research, but I met up with people who keep pigeons for racing as well, which was interesting. So, a lot of research, a lot of reading, from just, you know, more lighthearted things on pigeons to very detailed papers and documentaries and, that sort of thing.
Over what kind of distance can they navigate? And, you know, it seems extraordinary that they can fly from France back to Britain.
It is incredible. So, it's a matter of kind of building them up. They can't do it straight away.
Building up their physical ability.
Yeah, and also building up their navigation skills. So they'd be moved further and further away from their home in Loft. But the idea is that they'd home back to the Loft that they've come to know. But it is incredible how they can do it. And I think water is a little bit of an issue to pigeons, and Blue brings that up in the story. He's afraid to fly over water, and that has been an issue and can be an issue to pigeons. They don't like flying over huge bodies of water. I think it upsets their compass. I don't know exactly why, but
How far can they fly without resting?
I can't remember.
I guess birds do fly from one
A long way, but they do take rests. And I think it, again, depends on training and whether they've been trained as racing pigeons or whether they're just more people's sort of family homing pigeons. But they can fly a significant distance, and they have really strong chest muscles, which allows them to keep going for such a long distance. They really are the athletes of the bird world, which people don't really think of, but they are actually natural athletes.
So I'm always interested in this too, that if you hadn't adopted your pigeon and you had found this story, just say, would the story have passed you by, do you think? Or was it your having adopted a pigeon and then finding the story that kind of really ignited it for you?
That definitely ignited it. I don't know whether the story would have passed me by, because I can't remember when I first thought about it, but I know it was in my head for a long time, a different take on the story, I think. I always thought of writing about a little girl who adopted or who had homing pigeons and one was taken to war. So that was in my head for many, many years. But I think the change in perspective and the writing from the pigeon's point of view and seeing it from that way sort of came about from adopting the pigeon.
So you've touched on the research, because there's obviously like a lot of macro research, and also you've got some fairly micro elements in there as well. So how did you approach doing the research, and did you have any particular standout discoveries?
Yeah, well, I love the research. That's a huge part of my writing for me. I'm not as organized with my research as I am with my writing, because I tend to just go off on tangents. But I did a significant amount of research before I even started. I think it's hard to write a book like that without having a good basis. So, I mean, the first scene set in Sandringham, I needed to know a lot about Sandringham, even just the layout of Sandringham, before I could write even that chapter. So I do a lot of research before I start. But as I go on, I'm always stopping. I'll go off and do some research. I've got to try and stop myself running off on mad tangents. But sometimes that's how you discover these amazing little anecdotes that find their way into the story. Sometimes they don't, but you can discover so many things when you're on these little research tangents. I've just got to be careful that it doesn't distract me too much, which it can sometimes from the writing. I sort of say, right, today I've got to write X amount of words, and I'm not allowed to go on a research tangent till I've completed those amount of words.
So do you start with a fairly an overview of the historical period, and then as you're writing, come down more into the specific kind of details of things?
Right. So sort of an overview of the period I'm dealing with, the locations, the stories, the pigeon stories themselves, a lot of general background reading, and then, yes, focusing more on the specifics. And
were there any kind of new or specific research techniques that you discovered doing this? Anything you did differently?
No, I wouldn't say there was any specific techniques. I think I definitely researched. There was a lot more to research. It was a much wider body of research than my previous historical fiction. So I felt my previous one was very much focused on certain areas. It was on a submarine, so I did a significant amount of research into submarines. Whereas this one, there was so much to research that I found it took a lot more of matter time. But I wouldn't say I had a specific techniques that.
Maybe you could just talk about your deployment of point of view and how you kind of negotiated some of those things.
I like writing from an animal's point of view. So it was, my first book was written from a reindeer's point of view. So I'd had a bit of experience with writing from an animal's point of view. I think a pigeon's was easier than a reindeer. I think maybe because I'd already had the experience, and also because I think there's a lot more information out there on pigeons and haven't had experience with pigeons. But yeah, before I even started, I did a lot of research on pigeons so I could kind of pinpoint that point of view, from, you know, their biology to their mannerisms, watching documentaries, that sort of thing, so that I could really absorb myself into a pigeon's world before I could begin to think about how they might be thinking or acting and their movements, that sort of thing. But it's kind of that balance, because you're adding human thoughts as well to the animal. So it's getting that balance between being a genuine animal narrator, but also bringing in like human personalities and thoughts to your animal character. But it's a lot of fun to do. And I'm kind of drawn to writing everything from animals' point of view at the minute, which is a little bit dangerous because it's not something that publishers are that keen on. There's not a lot of books out there written from animals' point of view. And it was very difficult to get my first book over the publication line, primarily for the reason that I chose to write it from a reindeer's point of view as opposed to third person.
I just kind of thought with Royal Blue, when he revealed that he was multilingual and could speak French as well, I just kind of, for myself, that was a flap of his wings a bit too far for me.
Maybe. I needed to get the fact that he understood French and into it a little bit later on, but yes.
it's hard to do that anyway when you've got human characters coming into another environment, so. You've used illustrations in the novel, which are quite charming. Did you kind of conceive of those as you wrote the novel, or were they kind of added in later?
No, that was the publisher's idea, and they were added in later. They are beautiful, and I think they do really add something to the story. Wasn't my idea. It was my publisher's. I did get to suggest what I would like illustrated.
The points of the novel that you would like illustrated?
Yeah, sort of the points. And I really wanted one of Lilibet by Queen Alexander's Nest. So I was like, oh, please illustrate that one. It was just a sort of a negotiation of what points in the book an illustration would work well.
Yeah. No, they are really, they are quite charming. The other thing I noticed was that the font that it's published in changes to a kind of fuzzy handwritten font at certain points. So I was just kind of wondering how that came about and how the decisions were made around about that.
Yeah, so again, that was at the editing stage. So a similar thing was done in my first novel. So we just kind of carried it through to this one. But yeah, that was just, again, something that we decided to do at the editing stage. And I think it kind of broke up the text in a way. I like it.
Yeah, I think it adds impact or emphasis,
which I think for a younger reader
might be a really useful thing. And it also, you know, and I don't mean this in a derogatory manner, but it kind of lent towards a cartoon kind of in a way that I have no idea if children read cartoons anymore, but you know, it must have facilitated a child coming into a more kind of adult text by having these kind of tropes from something that they possibly recognize.
So something I automatically write into my writing now, I'll put a lines and do those italics. So I think it's something I've kind of adopted for.
So what's special or different about writing CYA, do you think?
Yeah, I love writing for children. So I think I would probably struggle to write an adult book. Because I'm naturally inclined towards children's stories. I think it's partly the fact that children's books, as a child, they form such an important part of your life. And I think it's the way that you can carry those books through to adulthood that I really love. I find that so beautiful about books. So the books that I loved in my childhood that I still sort of carry with me in my heart. So I love the fact that, you know, I could be writing for children and that my book, you know, might find a place in their heart and follow them through their life. But yeah, it gives me a great excuse to read kids' books and fill my shelves with kids' books because I'm writing children's books. So not that I should need an excuse, but yeah, I think it's just, I just love writing for children.
But writing a story about World War II, I mean, quite a lot of the novels that have done well in the ARA Historical Novel Prize have been set in World War II, which I kind of find a bit odd for CYA fiction to be set there, yeah. Because it brings up a whole lot of problems of how far can you go and how much do you have to sanitize the stories. So were you kind of aware of that when you were working?
I think I automatically, because I only write for children, I think I automatically think about that while I'm writing, and I won't, if anything, I might need to up my sort of what I include a bit more. Maybe I'm more cautious than anything, I would say. But yeah, I think it's a great way of looking at the war for children, you know, getting that insight through a story. There's so much they can learn and, you know, just imagining themselves in that place. And I think that's so important. I know as a child, I loved, it was Goodnight, Mr. Tom, Michelle McGorrigan, which was a historical fiction at the time. And I loved the fact that it was probably my first introduction to historical fiction for children. And it was just the idea of imagining myself as an evacuee. And you can read about these things in history books, but you don't really feel them. And it's getting that full empathy, putting yourself in that place. And I think it's just a wonderful way to introduce children to history, but particularly to the war, where you're dealing with things that are, you know, difficult. And I think writing historical fiction and writing about the war for children in that way is a great introduction for them.
Yeah, I think the advantage you had as well was that your story's kind of almost like an allied story. It's not about a direct battle or a direct problem. It's kind of
that's
literally this bird that was flying over the top of it. So, you know, I think you escaped a lot of the problems I've encountered when I've read other CYA novels that are directly tackling the Holocaust or something, you know, as big as that.
Yeah. So mine only really, it's touching on issues, but generally in a much more overview way.
Whenever I read these CYA novels, I always try to imagine them as an adult novel and just what, you know, what could be done to do that. You know, the other one from this year, Rebecca Lim's Two Sparrowhawks and a Lonely Sky.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I really enjoyed that novel just because I have some knowledge of Hong Kong and things, and I just kept imagining it as an adult novel. It felt slightly kind of constrained to me. I'm just wondering if you had ever thought of developing these into an adult novel, and if so, what kind of things do you think you would have to change to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really think about it at the time, but I think probably because my tendency, I'm very animal focused and telling the story from an animal point of view, I think how that would work for an adult novel, I mean, it has been done and I love the ones that have done it. Abel C. Cat Simon was a war book written for adults, primarily written by the cat or told by the cat. And that worked really well. But I just felt that I'm not sure my story would fit an adult, certainly not told by a pigeon. I think it would have to be changed a lot, because I think the whole reason I use an animal narrator is to make history more accessible and understandable for children, to help them sort of, you're seeing it through another naive character. And so it's that kind of naivety of telling the story from an animal's point of view. So I think I would be loath to do that for adults. I'm not sure how well it would work or how well I could do it. So probably not in that way, but whether I would look at that, I mean, I would take a whole different take on the story, I think, if I was writing it for adults. It definitely wouldn't be from the pigeon's viewpoint. And for me, that's what I love doing. Yeah. So probably not.
Yeah, because the naive or character in any novel is a really great device. if you're in that point of view, because then the reader and the character can discover together. So it becomes a lot more natural.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the reason I sort of started doing that was my first novel was set on a submarine, and that's really difficult to explain to children, the inner workings of a submarine. I had to learn it all myself. So I found having the animal narrator, you can explain that to children as the reindeer discovers things so they can learn. And the same with Blue in this story. You're having that naive take on war, but as he learns about things, so the children can learn too.
Yeah.
So it's kind of seeing it through almost like another, it's almost like telling a story by a child. It's having those innocent, naive eyes.
So was it risky to have the future Queen of England as a character?
I think it was quite bold. And to be honest, I expected my editor, when it went through to editing, to say, take it out. but she didn't. So yeah, I just ran with it. It was something I really wanted to do. And I think because the story is, it's Royal Blue. He was a pigeon owned by King George VI. So I wanted to bring the royal history into it to a certain extent. But I had this dream of having a scene with Lilibet meeting Blue. And and I thought the idea of the parallel between King George VI becoming king and doing his duty, even though that wasn't what initially was intended, and Lilibet could sort of explain that to Blue, and Blue could use that as his foundation for actually doing his duty and going to the MPS, I thought was a lovely kind of parallel. I just really liked it. But yeah, it was, I thought it was a little bit maybe bold, but the editor let me do it. And I was very careful in the way I portrayed her. And I also did a lot of research into even just that chapter itself. So I did quite a bit of research into the Queen as a child, and the little anecdotes about her riding the subway with her nanny. You know, I pulled that out from the history I researched. So I tried to sort of ground it in reality and present a positive point of view. It was a little bit bold, I think, perhaps. But I hope she'd like it.
It's kind of true that her life did have a period where she was royalty, but she wasn't in the main, she wasn't born to be queen. So she became queen, which is different to her children and her grandchildren and things.
Yeah, that's right.
It is quite. Did she die while you were writing it, or had she died?
Yes, while I was writing it. So I had this romantic notion that when I finished, I was going to send a copy. She was going to read it. sadly, she did die when I was writing the book. So
what are you working on now? What's news?
So, now more historical fiction. So I finished, last year I finished a book based on the life story of an elephant set in former Myanmar in Burma. And it's a little bit different because it spans the whole life of an elephant, but it culminates in World War II when the Japanese invaded Burma, and this elephant leads a remarkable rescue across the mountains. So it again is inspired by a true story, and I loved writing that. And I was lucky enough to get an ARA, I was lucky enough to get an art essay grant to travel to Thailand, to the mountains, and live in a village with a Karen tribe. And so it was just on the border with Myanmar. Couldn't actually go into Myanmar, but it was very close to the border. So I got to live with the Karen tribe and who work with elephants and live with elephants. So that was great, and great for my perspective as well, because again, I'm telling the story from an animal's point of view. So that was great to actually see elephants in their wild or semi-wild habitat. So that was great. So I'm still trying to find a publisher for that one, but I couldn't wait to start my next one. So now I'm working on something set in Australia, which I really wanted to do. And it's great from a research point of view. So it's set in South Australia in the 1880s, and it's based on the story of a railway dog. But I'm loving doing that because I live quite near to the railway museum. So I have that resource right on my doors. But also I have all the history around me. And I'm finding that fascinating because I'm learning so much about Adelaide and South Australia in that time period. So that's my next one.
Goodness, a busy life. So maybe you can humour us mere mortals and tell us what it's like to win a prize like the ARA Historical Novel Prize.
Oh, yeah, it was incredible. It's absolutely, definitely the highlight of my writing career. Yeah, and just being there, receiving the award, it was so important. It meant so much to me. And I think as writers, we really doubt ourselves. So to receive an award like that and get recognition for what I've done, yeah, was life-changing. And it's kept me going writing the historical fiction because, you know, there are ups and downs with writing and probably a lot more downs. And I think I was at a point there where I was thinking maybe I won't write any more historical fiction because it's quite hard to sell to publishers. And you know, the audience is maybe a little bit more restricted in the children's market. It's harder to market. So I was at that point in my career where I was thinking, you know, maybe it's time I started to write something different, even though my heart didn't want to. So, yeah, winning this prize for me sort of was that validation I needed to say, yeah, you can do it. Keep going. So I have.
Wow. Yeah. And that's a huge prize and a huge honor. So
huge prize. Yeah. And a real honor.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for your time today. I've enjoyed our chat and I can safely say I'll never walk through the Martin Place pigeons in quite the same way again. So.
Yeah. I love that. I love that people say they never look at pigeons the same way again after reading my book. It's yay.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2025 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find a wealth of interviews. And it's festival year, History Unbound, to be held at Parramatta Town Hall on the 1st and 2nd of November, 2025. Both in person and online tickets are available. Please visit our website www.hnsa.org.au, register for our newsletter, and join our social media groups to be up to date. I'm Greg Johnston. Keep reading, keep listening, and keep imagining the past. Imagining the Past is commercial free. HNSA is a volunteer run, not-for-profit organisation, and we can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website, www.hnsa.org.au. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated.